Hey, welcome back, everybody, to my podcast and Happy New Year. Today, we're going to start off the new year with a non-basketball episode. And today's guest is Andrew Tribble, who comes from the world of rugby, rugby union, to be exact. He's a former player and current entrepreneur. And we talked about the nuances and the dynamics within the rugby union culture, particular rugby ethos. He talked about the values and certain things that you can't find in other sports, perhaps. But also about his company. It's called Kairos, that also brings club and players on the same page. It's a communication platform, which everybody knows communication is right down my alley. That platform can also be used for youth academies and in particular for clubs to communicate internally with the coaching staff and optimize scheduling. I hope you enjoy this episode. You can find Andrew on all social media. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, please comment, like, share, and tune in next time as well. Bye. Andrew, what's up, man? Thanks for coming onto my show.
Thanks for having me, Ben. I was looking forward to it.
Yeah, we had a short chat in October, if I remember correctly, and I felt like we connected very easily, and hopefully we can dive into more of the stuff that we talked about.
Yeah, it's that kind of high-performance conversation, and I felt like a few things that you were interested in were kind of really resonating quite strongly with me, and obviously my background as a player, and then now, you know, as an entrepreneur trying to create a solution, technology solution that solves a lot of the problems that I had firsthand. I know we got into that a little bit and the cultural implications and different teams and how they communicate differently. And yeah, I think we could have talked all day. So no doubt this will be the same, Ben.
Yeah, it's communication is right down my alley. So we'll dive into that shortly. You're my second non-basketball guest, so keep that in mind that we have a basketball audience. So anything that when we talk about rugby union or related to the team nuances, just keep that in mind. And you still, as a non-basketball guest, you still have to make Ireland proud. You're the first Irish guest, so it's you have a lot of pressure on today.
Looking forward to it. If I don't do give a good account of myself, then I'll feel like I've let all of Ireland down and all of the rugby community worldwide down. So I'll try my best just to represent them well, Ben.
Okay, well, otherwise we just won't publish it.
Sounds good.
So before we dive into the, I have several topics prepared, but before we dive into the locker room dynamics, coaches dynamics, communication amongst the two, I wanted to go a little bit into background and also just maybe you can just break down a little bit of the difference between rugby union and rugby league and why you chose specifically rugby union, if I understand correctly. What was the background in that and how did you choose between the two?
The quick answer is there's very little rugby union. Sorry, there's very little rugby league in Ireland. They do have a team. The World Cup was played in England a couple of months ago, and they do have a team and they compete reasonably well. But I wasn't really familiar with rugby league. I still don't even really follow rugby league that closely. And people assume if you're a rugby union fan, there must be some crossover. But the two sports are sat pretty separately. You do get guys crossover from league to union or union to league. Usually based on the financial reasons, to be honest. If someone's going well in league, they tend to come across to union. There's bigger opportunities financially in union. I think certainly in the UK, in Australia, league would be a bit stronger financially, potentially. But for me, I never really had the opportunity because like everybody else, I was a product of my environment. My dad played rugby union. And I was a soccer fan when I was a kid, and I remember he confiscated. I had an English Premier League annual, and he confiscated that and replaced it with an Irish rugby book. And then that was more or less the decision made. And so, as much as you're a product of your environment, it's not usually that obvious and that blatant. Here's a book about a sport that you will be interested in, son. So I didn't really have that much
choice.
Yeah, that much choice. Which in the end, I was glad Because I'm a bit of a sports fan, but I'm a very surface level sports fan in every other sport apart from rugby union, which I follow very closely. I commentate in games and do some punditry and on TV and radio and stuff like that. So I suppose I have to follow it closely to be up to speed with the game. But the big differences, and I know you asked there about the big differences between league and union. There's a lot more moving parts in union. The scrum is more complicated. The line out there is no line out in rugby league. The breakdown, which is the rock, which is, you know, anybody who'd be new to rugby union, if they saw a breakdown or a rock, they would just say that's a load of guys lying on top of each other and just chaos, whereas there's actually a little bit of structure to it. But rugby league is different because they just play. They play, once you get tackled, that's one. They count to five tackles in a row, and then you turn over the ball, basically. So usually they kick the ball at that stage. So it's probably slightly less technical, rugby league. And there's a few bigger collisions as well. There's probably less focus on safety, to be honest. So I think rugby league players tend to be tougher, more physical, and there's some collisions in rugby league I just couldn't even imagine being a part of. People maybe say that about rugby union as well, but two sports are even culturally quite different as well. Different backgrounds and different kind of typical demographics playing them. But very little crossover, I would say, between the two sports.
It's interesting. I didn't know it was that big of a difference, because you know, when you hear, you think rugby and you think maybe there's a slight difference in rules, because I know there's 15 and 13 players on the each sport. And it's still the same ball, right? It's still more or less the same idea behind it. It's just that some nuances to it that make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's just the breakdown is the big thing. So when you get tackled in rugby league, then the defense go back 10 meters, and then only the tackler is allowed to stay up beside the ball carrier, and then they go again. Basically, you're allowed to place the ball, you roll the ball underneath your foot, and then you play it again. Mm-hmm. And that just doesn't happen. Every time you get tackled in rugby union, there's a competition for that ball. So everybody, it's called the breakdown or the rock, and players from both teams compete over the ball to see who wins. And then, you know, so it's a little bit more difficult to maintain the ball. But then in theory, if you continue to look after every breakdown or win the ball every time there's a rock, you could have the ball for an infinite number of phases, but that never happens. You always get someone gets a turnover. Turnover, it's called, if you are successful and bring that ball back.
So just a question popped in my mind. Is strength the biggest factor in those situations, or is there tactics more important than strength? What's the if you put a percentage on it?
In the breakdown,
in the breakdown,
so defensively you get guys and things go in and out of style, and there are certain law changes along the last kind of 15 years that have changed how players can compete for the ball. There's two ways a team can compete to turn over a ball, you know, that they were defending and now they're attacking. If the ball carrier goes to ground and a defender is able to get over and compete for the ball, so like it's called a poach or a jackal, they basically kind of they crouch down into a squat position and then they try and compete for the ball. But importantly, the defender has to maintain their own body weight. They can't go over the handlebars. They can't have they'd be leaning on their hands on the ball, but they have to try and take the ball. And then the principle is that the attacking player, when they're on the ground, they have to release the ball. So if they have to release the ball, you need a teammate to go out, get over the ball and clean out that defender before they have an opportunity to get over the ball and compete for that ball. So it's crazy how when you know the sport well and you grew up playing the sport, having to explain it like I've just done is such a foreign thing, and it's an unusual place to be, but it's quite a challenging thing to describe that.
I can imagine it's something. It's for me also challenged because I was never affiliated with any sort, I mean, either rugby denomination, because it's just not in the world that I grew up. It was not the norm to watch it, you know. So it's also, you see it on TV, they showed it on TV, but you never I never got exposed to the culture as much. Same thing with American football. I was never exposed to the culture as much. In Germany, they're starting to show some American football on TV in my teenager years. And I was not so much into it, because when you don't know the rules, you're not as much invested. So you just slip through. But then when I went to the U.S. and I lived in the U.S. and my high school was one of the top teams in the nation, everybody goes to Friday night football. Everybody goes to watch the high school day. And then you start learning the rules. And then all of a sudden you just like, this is awesome. You know, so the more you know, like, explaining is one thing, it's theoretical, but once you are exposed to it and you watch it and you're around the people that are watching it, you witness the emotional investment, you get much more invested in it as well. And you start to appreciate it more. So now it's going to be hard for a listener also to appreciate the theory of it, but it's a small tidbit, I think, for people just to maybe be a little bit more open to other sports as well.
And you find, so that's important. Like whenever you go to the university, you go, you know, kind of 19, 20, 21, those are years whenever, if you're, as you say, if you're immersed in something, and I've seen this with friends of mine who haven't grown up as soccer fans, but they go across to university, to college in England, where soccer is enormous over there. And if you go to Newcastle, you become a Newcastle United fan. You go to Manchester, you're either United or City, or, you know, and there's such an intense rivalry that they just get carried away with it. And then after 3 years, they come back and they just know everything about football, soccer. And it's crazy, the impact, just being immersed in something. And then, so even just like, there's the technicalities of knowing the rules and, you know, why this happens, why that happens. But then there's just understanding a game. And like, even what I described to you, if a breakdown happened a different way and I saw something that just looked unusual, I would know instinctively that that was wrong. Like, that he's going to get done for that. He's going to get penalized for that. Or there's going to be a penalty the other direction. But I wouldn't be able to explain why. That's not right. I don't know why. But I've just seen enough breakdowns or rocks or games that doesn't look quite right. There's something going on there. And then obviously, you know, then the smarter guys can look at flaws and say, this is why this isn't correct.
Yeah, same thing for me with basketball. When I watch basketball, your eye is already schooled for certain situations, for certain actions. And you already anticipate what's going to come next. You see what's happening with your bare eyes and you kind of... you know what will happen next. And as when I sit around my friends or other people, I'm already saying, oh no, you know, because I see this action happening. And then it just 1-2 seconds later, it happens because your eyes, once you've put in so many hours and you watched it, you've been exposed to it, your eyes recognize certain actions. The same thing with coaching will, you know, when scouting, coaching other opponents, You've watched on tape so many times and you've seen their lineups, their formations, the five guys that are out there, you know, you just see who would they call the play call for, and you already know what the team is going to think. I'm starting to think for the coach, you know, so it's starting to become more of an anticipation, and the process is happening, as you know, in my head as it's happening on the field, on the court. Yeah. So I'm sure, you know, I think that's just the professional eye, let's call it. I don't know.
You see, I think you see patterns. I think you find this in rugby and in defense. You'll see, like, whether it's so there's only a certain number of things that can happen, because, and if you play, you know, I played for 12 years professionally. If you play for 3 years, 4 years, you've probably seen everything that can possibly happen. Because it's not possible that something can happen that they haven't already. If you see a shape, you kind of generally tend to know that it just looks like it's going to unfold this way. And if you've seen enough shapes, then, and even just you see enough kind of examples of different body language, different pieces of body language from different players, putting their hands up at a different time, changing direction at a different time, you start to kind of spot cues. I think it's like playing chess. You know, I don't play that much chess, to be honest, but you know, if you see a certain shape, you know, I gather, you know, the player can react and, you know, understand how to be defensive or how to look after themselves or how maybe to counterattack that opportunity. So it's seeing shapes and then identifying that this is what that shape is gonna look like next, or here's the options available off that shape.
Yeah, you're observing and you're kind of you're you're anticipating. You know, you're just anticipating. You see your instincts have already schooled you on you know, from your past. So I think that your experience, the more experience you get, the more you are also reflecting after you've went through some games, mm-hmm. through some maybe wins, losses, and you've gotten the feel for the situations. You also get to observe and anticipate what's going to happen next just by, let's say, body language or certain actions. What's creeping in, your eye already recognizes it.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that you were playing for one club your whole career, Ulster. How come? Like you just stayed loyal. You felt like that was the right situation for you to succeed, or was there? Well, you could have. Rugby union played in other countries as well. Was there not the appeal to go out of the country?
There was an appeal for me. It was the club I grew up supporting, so I was very, very tied to that club. That doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, the other options aren't available. But I was interested at one stage whenever I felt like I was in a small bit of a slump. I felt like I needed something to change my behavior, something to spark a new kind of initiative or new opportunity for me. And I did look elsewhere at that stage. And the perfect move never came up. I would only have moved away from my club that I grew up supporting and I played for my whole life. I would only move away from that if there was the perfect opportunity. And the perfect opportunity would be, you know, a different league, a side that I felt like I would suit, a team that maybe a coach that I kind of thought would appreciate what I would bring. And then, you know, financially, it had to make sense as well. And it had to make sense for my family, moving elsewhere, make sure my wife's a doctor, wanted to make sure there would be something for her as well. There was one at one stage I did look elsewhere and it wasn't perfect. So it didn't work out. And in the end, that was the year, that was 2013, 2014, in around then. Sorry, 2013 it was. And it didn't work out, and I was glad it didn't work out, because the following year, this was after that kind of slump, whenever I got to grips with what made me tick. I felt like something landed, and I understood how to get the best out of myself a little bit better, and I understood what made me tick. There was a new coach arrived with Ireland at the time, and he made performance a lot more accessible to me, so I kind of followed his lead in that. And he got the best out of me, and I just got to this new level of performance, having experienced that that slump. So I needed something different. I thought what I needed was a change of scenery, a new club, a new team. But actually, it was a new coach in the same environment came in and then just changed my whole thinking and unlocked something, another level of performance for me. And if I'd gone elsewhere, I never would have got to experience that. We won the Six Nations, which is an international rugby tournament between England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, France, and Italy. We won the Six Nations that year. It was the first time we won the Six Nations in 5 or 6 years. So it was pretty special to be a part of that. I never would have experienced that if I'd gone elsewhere, because you don't get selected for the national team if you play your club rugby outside of Ireland. So that would have been a big mistake, although I never would have found that out, so might have got away with it.
But timing is everything in life. Once again, I say it over and over again, when timing hits you, it's unpredictable, but you feel it, and you just got to be at the right place, right time, and then take advantage of the opportunity, and it came to you at the right time. Sounds like it.
Absolutely, yeah. It was one of those things, and you can overthink these things quite a bit. And I looked at an opportunity. It wasn't right. It didn't feel quite right. This is the way things worked out. You know, couldn't have worked out better, because I had a very, very amazing experience. I probably had the best season of my life that following season. So yeah, I got lucky. I suppose I leveraged that luck then for the next couple of years and continue to get lucky. I suppose you make your own luck in this game, and you know, I got lucky at the start, but then I found out a lot about myself, and I found out how to get the best out of myself, and that served me for a few years after.
Yeah, and I was reading up a little bit on rugby just to get a better idea of it, and I read a little bit of mental health. So is there some sort of crisis or some sort of, as I know in the NFL, American football, there is a little bit of the CTE, or not a little bit, there's a lot of CTE just the topic itself is hovering over the NFL and over American football in general. But is there a concern about that in the rugby community about the repercussions of the contact and the physical play?
Yeah. There's a few. There's been a couple of studies done recently the head collisions have been been not proved. I'm not sure exactly what way to describe that, but there's been a connection between head collisions and early onset dementia, motor neuron disease, this kind of stuff. And I know there's been a few high profile players who've got really horrible symptoms and really struggling with that, and with families and stuff 10 years after retirement, and staring down a pretty unpleasant future. So there's been law legal action from in Ireland, Wales and England. So yeah, we're not sure exactly what way that's going to go, and the sport is very aware that they have there's been a big emphasis to lower the tackle height to avoid head collisions or shoulders on heads. And we've seen that in the last couple of years, red cards if someone gets sent off, they've been given way more readily than they would have in previous years, just because they're really trying to hammer this message home. Mm-hmm. To make the games safer, and it being a game that I've loved and my kids play, I want the game to be as safe as possible, obviously, so I'm a big advocate for that. It's important that we get all the good things from rugby, the culture, the environment, the teamwork, the ethos, the everything, all the good stuff that came from rugby and all the benefits that I have, but also remove any of the difficulties with the sport and any of the dangerous elements attached to it.
So let's talk a little bit about the ethos. So what's the specifics in the rugby culture that you may not find in other sports? Because I read the book Legacy, it came out in 2013. I just looked it up because I remembered what, and I read it probably 15, 16, and it really it left a mark. And I'm wondering if that was another impactful book for the rugby culture, just to hammer the message down of culture and the ethos that I think that you're talking about.
I think every sport would imagine that they have a basketball community, a rugby community, and they look after each other, and there's the real ethos. And no doubt, objectively, rugby is probably no difference. But certainly, whenever you're in it, it feels like there's a lovely environment with rugby, especially in Ireland, because it's politically in Ireland there's a north-south thing, and rugby doesn't see that. Rugby just sees culturally, politically, it's all traditionally up north. Rugby was a British sport, but down south that's not the case, and it's nice that rugby is an all-Ireland sport. So whenever I play for Ireland, I'm representing the entire island, whereas soccer, it's Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. So I think that's a nice thing, and it's for me, it's been very good to kind of broaden my horizons and let me meet some people on the island everywhere, these different kind of communities and environments that I wouldn't have had any access to before. So there's that. But also then the kind of the more subtle version, I suppose, of the cultural element of the rugby community, just looking out for each other and having that kind of rugby family and rugby ethos. It's a big thing in soccer. They scream and shout at the referee. In rugby, they don't tend to do that. They just tend to be a little bit more understanding, a little bit more polite. That's not always the case at all, and there's been plenty of examples where that hasn't been the case. But generally, it would be considered that people are a lot more polite to the referee, polite to teammates. You get a drink, you say hi to your teammates after the game. Maybe you wouldn't get that in soccer as much. I'm hamming this up too much and definitely giving it too much, but there's an element of kind of the rugby community and the rugby environment, the rugby ethos, that is kind of built on a little bit of respect and understanding and appreciation of the referees is a good example of how rugby would be considered probably a little bit unique in that way.
Interesting. That's because the referee is always the bad guy in every sport. He's always, yeah. I mean, the World Cup now in soccer showed it, that everybody was hammering down on the refs. In basketball, it happens all the time. That's an interesting viewpoint, just to be respectful to the lawmaker, I guess. How's the dynamic in the locker room within the teammates? If you just reflect on a day-to-day basis, what are the dynamics within the locker room of community? How do you connect with guys? Is there a lot of events that you guys go to together? Is there a culture building mindset, or how is the scene behind the scene?
Yes, I think the best teams are teams that are player led. And teams where you don't necessarily have to have a head coach or a director of rugby saying, here's how we're going to run this team, where you've got enough senior players. Senior players tend to be older players. Older players tend to be more old-fashioned players. And this is the way we've always done it. So that needs to be challenged as well. I think probably the best teams are teams where they've got open-minded, older, experienced players, senior players, and then innovative, creative, forward-thinking, progressive younger players to challenge that as well. And you've got a nice kind of balance of youth versus senior guys and older guys and experienced guys. But importantly, the point I was making is that players have to drive that culture, and players have to drive, what way do we want to play? What way do we want to be seen off the pitch? Who do we want to engage with? Do we want to have, good relationships with our supporters? Do we want to be accessible? That's another thing from rugby players. Tend to be a little bit more accessible, so supporters feel like there's more of a connection with the players. If money ruins everything, but if rugby became more professional or more popular and there was more of an injection of cash into rugby, then you'd probably lose that almost like straight away, because higher paid players are nowhere near as accessible, and nowhere you can identify with players as well, and then they tend to be more transient. So there's a lot of reasons why, rugby tends to have that, just because it's players are, there's not as much money in rugby as there is in soccer, for example, or basketball or a lot of sports out there. And that's all well and good having that environment, that culture, until you introduce more money and then the same challenges come, and then, maybe you don't have that. But I think it needs to be player driven. I think what's acceptable, if the players decide what's acceptable, is way more powerful and way stronger than the coaches saying this is acceptable, this isn't acceptable. And I'm talking about culturally, I'm talking about in terms of performance as well. So both elements of that.
Interesting, because that reminds me a little bit of Australian basketball. I talked to coaches and I've seen practices, I've seen games, obviously, but when I watch practice behind the scenes of particular teams in Australia, I see them after the practice, and maybe it's the same that you've experienced during your career, that they huddle up and the coach doesn't talk to players. Each player talks and takes ownership and says something that is important for the group and has their viewpoint of how to get better, what's the accountability kind of, everybody talks about what they can do better, but also what's better for the team and where everybody else slacked off, and calling each other out also with a good intent. So I don't know if that's also common in your circles, or if it was common when you were in London.
Yeah, it would be. There's a guy called Johnny Sexton who's Ireland. He's the Brady of Irish rugby. So he's nowhere near as old, but he's 37, but he's still the most important player for Ireland. Ireland are nowhere near the same team that they would be without him. The way I would describe him is he's not only the best player, he's not only the captain, but he's the coach as well. And he's the guy who drives everything, because he just eats, sleeps and drinks and breathes rugby and performance for his team, Leinster, and Ireland when he's playing for Ireland. Because he's a perfect example of someone who drives standards, and just he is the one who dictates what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And it's not just him on a power trip, it's him wanting the team to perform well and then influencing the people left and right of him, and then this whole cultural shift in terms of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And then it's not acceptable not to recover, so everybody recovers better. It's not acceptable not to be prepared for games, so everybody prepares for games better, and there's less mistakes, there's less people don't know their plays, guys are always way better prepared. And just the influence of one player that, he's 37, there's kids in that team You know, could be 10 years younger, or 15 years younger, and this was their hero. What, you know, watching him play rugby on TV whenever they were teenagers.
Yeah.
And the impact of him saying this is acceptable, this isn't acceptable, is very, very powerful. And it's it drives a whole culture in a club, and it drives performance, and it drives results ultimately.
So what's the coach do? what is the coach there for? In
that's a good that's a good question, because sometimes the less a coach says, the better. Sometimes a real skill from a coach can be just shut up. You know, I've been in rooms where, you know, a senior player or a kind of inexperienced player has put their hand up and said something really impactful, really moving, and just on the money. And I've watched the impact from that comment be reduced by a coach, you know, following up with something else afterwards. Just shut up. You just need to shut up. You didn't know that person has nailed that. You just need to shut up and let that settle and enjoy the silence of the impact of that silence as well.
Self awareness.
Yeah, and understand that, you know, they don't have to be the only voice. If they're the only voice, then other voices will get less and less and less, and then you get fed up hearing the same voice every day. So they need to understand that there's a massive value and impact from voices elsewhere, and having a diversity in that. I think the general kind of trend would be, I think, the coach being most vocal at the start of the week. And then as that week goes on, so the first 2 days, kind of, you know, attack day, defense day, recovery day, obviously guys are kind of not in as formally, but attack day, defense day, the coaches are kind of be more vocal. And I think as that week unfolds, all of the prep is done. So once you get to those kind of shorter sessions towards the end of the week, getting ready for a game day on Saturday, I know basketball isn't exactly the same because there's a quicker turnaround, but getting closer to the game, you got to hand over. And it's the same thing in my world in the minute in business, you know, handing over to guys and giving them ownership and empowering them and saying, listen, we've done everything we can for you now. Now just get on the pitch. And we're not saying do what you're told. We're saying here's all of the tools to help you perform. Go out on the pitch and you do what you do best, because we're empowering you, allowing you to be yourself out there as well. And there's a couple of guys who are going to contribute a bit of voice and a bit of comms and a bit of information when it's suitable. But handing over the reins to the players. And then if you've got a player group that you can trust and rely on, then I think it's easier to do that. And it reduces the temptation for coaches to be always talking and then just, you know, polluting the communication and in the run up to a game.
That's where the problem can come sneak in, I think, because there will be times where you will have players on your team that think that they know and they think that they say something smart, but they're actually destroying or not destroying necessarily, but not helping. You know, and they just like to talk, and somebody else is trying to talk on top of that. So it really would rely on having good senior leadership for everybody else to follow and fall in line. If you don't have that, then the coach would have to be a really experienced coach to, you know, to see where he has to talk more and where he has to guide the team towards.
Yeah, and then I think it would be useful for I've been in situations where coaches have took aside, you know, less experienced players, but players that they know are respected within that player group, and just saying, listen, it's important that your voice is heard. Your voice is really, really important with this player group. And it's not all, it doesn't always have to be Johnny Sexton, the senior guy. It doesn't have to be the obvious voice. But what you have to say could be a different perspective and could add something really nice, a nice blend of it might not be that articulate, it might not be that well worded or that well thought through, but there could be a raw passion from what someone has to contribute, and that could be really important. It could just be exactly what a team needs. And they tend to be underrepresented. I think it takes a while for guys to feel confident enough to communicate what they have to say, but it can be really impactful, I think.
Yeah, you have to develop a certain feel, and like you have feel for the game, but you have to also have the feel for a situation of when to say, when not to say, what to say, how emotional you can get sometimes, when to shut up. So it's both sides, players and coaches, and I think those dynamics within the locker room where everybody is kind of feeling it out. Sometimes you have too many alpha dogs that can also just stir it up too much. And I've been on teams where we were most successful when there was actually turmoil during the tournaments within the locker room. And that caused the team to come together even closer after the conflict happened. You know, so I don't know if that's common in your past, if you experienced maybe in the locker rooms that you were in, but that's something that I've experienced, that sometimes there needs to be like a shock to the system for the guys to really fight, but come together stronger afterwards. And then everybody is kind of on their toes and has each other's back even more.
Yeah, I've seen that happen a number of times. And often it's less about a fight, like an argument, a fight, and more, you know, getting reasonably physical in training, and you know, a few kind of scuffles or a little bit of intensity in training. Less. I haven't seen it as much in an argument, because in an argument there tends to be someone's right and someone's wrong. Whereas, you know, whenever guys are being physical with each other in an intense, physical, demanding session, you know, they're just both fired up. They could both be wrong or both be right. In fact, they're probably both right. So the nature of that can get guys very focused and very, very prepared, very ready to go, to get to where they need to be to perform.
So you mentioned also the practice process during the week. I was wondering how many coaches are involved in the whole process, and what's the communication like between the assistant coaches and the players, and then where does the head coach come in? Does he let usually the assistant coaches do the work, or does the head coach do the work and the assistants help? How is that divided, and how does the communication work between the coaches and the players?
Yeah, it'll very much depend on the style of the particular coach. I've been in environments where you've got a bit of a control freak, and you've got, you know, this kind of head coach always wants to be heard, always wants their voice to be kind of front and center. And then other times, whenever, you know, the biggest strength of the coach, one I'm thinking of one in particular, was to bring in guys who can contribute in this way, you know, in a weakness of theirs, and contribute in this way, you know, in a way that maybe tactically or strategically they're not quite good enough to contribute that or to articulate that in a meeting. And then the best of all is someone who can hold court, you know, hold an audience and captivate the audience, but then knows that if you do that every single week, then you lose the impact of that. So someone who has enough humility and understanding to say, right, this is your week, or this is your, you know, in the basketball example, you know, the run up to this game, I want your voice to be driving all the messages. Here's the messages I want you to land, and letting you challenge this, and, you know, they're open to accountability and open to challenging that, but here's the message I think we should be landing because of the way we want to play, or because of that opposition, or maybe some history with this fixture. But here's the message that I think I want you to deliver, and I'm going to help you out and back you up, and I'm going to be right there. I'll contribute a bit, but I want you to be driving this. And I think that can work quite well. One coach takes ownership for this 3-day period, the run up to that game. Another coach steps up, and then just having a real kind of nice, fluid kind of understanding of the whole coaching ticket. I've seen that being done, and it works really well. The only problem is it worked probably better in basketball, I would imagine, because there's shorter turnarounds. But in rugby, you know, you've got the full week. And, you know, it could be a European Cup game, could be a URC, which is an easier kind of, you know, drop down in intensity. So maybe, you know, use a different coach for, you know, to drive the messages that are being delivered that week, and then step up for European. And it's time for the head coach to start. There's like a bigger kind of aura around that week and a bigger intensity. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a build up in tiers of opponents, kind of like what you want to emphasize and how. I mean, the series cannot be lost. Even the seriousness cannot be lost in the process, right? Even though you're playing against a weaker opponent or whatever, you still have to. Sometimes in basketball, it's even the opposite. When the coach knows that we're going to play against the weaker opponent, and he knows that the players know that, then he's even more intense trying to provoke them and influence them in a way where they feel not agitated, but they're going into the game mad, intense, just to have it over with, you know, because he knows that in the game, in the week where it's leading up to a serious opponent, a high level opponent, where you've played against a contender, they're going to be the coach needs to say less because they're going to be ready by themselves. They're going to be mentally focused. So it's kind of it's a little bit of an opposite effect there that coaches drive down in basketball from what I've witnessed.
Yeah. And that's just, naturally maybe a little bit of concern that, they would maybe take this fixture for granted, or, they think they could beat the team easily. And they want to drive home that message. You have to prepare the same way, regardless of who it is you're playing. There's definitely an element of that, I think.
How much video work is done?
Quite a lot. You'd have, obviously, everybody's expected to go through the game and contribute, some findings from the game for their own, personal review, but also for the team review. Couldn't we do this better? Would you consider looking at this? Or is this an area that we could improve? But then there'd be, early in the week, it's review, and then the shift, which tends to be preview, and then looking at what we did well and then what we need to work on going into the opposition for this weekend. A load of review for the coaches. The coaches go through an awful lot of video, and they have to be on top of things, and they have to be well ahead of schedule. They have to be in this week. They have to be looking forward to the next week's opposition. And review maybe three or four games of that team, and then prepare a plan, well ahead of the players. But don't let the players anywhere near that, because they have to be single-minded of what's next for them. So yeah, there's quite a lot of video review, even more so since I finished, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it's almost every day?
Most days, yeah. In my experience, the videos were always too long.
Yeah.
Because you don't consume.
What's too long? What's too long for you?
Oh, I think 15 minutes is too long. Yeah. We would have video meetings of 35, 40 minutes, and it's bananas. It's so counterintuitive. You can't focus for that long. You can't consume that and actually retain that information. So 15 minutes, I think, would be probably about right. And then just strip down. If you have five messages to deliver, just deliver two of them well, and the team will probably be better prepared.
Yeah, it's 10 to 15 minutes and get out of there, because you still have to go out and practice, or you still, like, this when you're drained mentally the whole time and then you have to go out and practice, the practice is not going to be productive because the guys are just mentally out of it. So I think it's a high demand if you're trying to force them into a 50-minute video session and then expect them to be on top of it for 2 hours on the practice court.
Yeah. Everybody's back gets stiff. Everybody's hamstrings are tighter because you've been sitting in a meeting room for 45 minutes. Yeah, it's a big ask.
Yeah. Is there a lesson that you still take today from any coach during your career that you feel like follows you until this day, that even transpires in your regular life?
I had a coach that this was tough love. This is a coach that the way I interpreted this, he didn't like me at the start. He didn't rate me. He didn't think I was good enough. In fact, he actually thought the opposite. He thought I was underachieving on my potential. And he just tortured me the first week. He was never that bad after that. But the lesson that I learned then was always be prepared to give an answer to any question. And always be prepared for every meeting. Anything that could come up, rehearse it, or have an opinion, or have something to contribute, something that's going to, benefit the whole team in the preparation for the next week's game. That's probably something that I learned, and I continue to use that letter, benefit from that lesson that I learned all the rest of the way through my rugby career, but probably even now, going into meetings in business or work, just knowing, have a key message that you can deliver, a key finding. Don't take the meeting on a tangent, but if you feel like the meeting needs a direction, provide that direction, or always have something ready to drive that direction.
So as your body works, your mind is supposed to work as well, and be on top of it and be ready to answer if you're asked.
Yeah.
If we're going into your retirement phase and you're preparing for retirement mentally, as well as physically, probably just to wind down, what was the preparation process for you mentally to make this step into your next identity? Was it harder to let go of your old identity, or was it harder to accept a new one?
Great question. Bess, I've got 5 minutes here, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So, for me, great question. I, I had achieved enough in rugby that I was happy to move on, and a big part of my identity was rugby. Obviously, I was, you know, Andrew, the Ireland player and, you know, the Ulster player, but I had enough going on outside of rugby that it wasn't everything to me. And it was a hobby. It was something I loved, something I was passionate about, but it wasn't my identity. And I think that allowed me to achieve enough success to feel like I hadn't left anything out there or hadn't any unfulfilled potential. I felt like I fulfilled my potential. I could have done better, but I think I did enough for me to feel satisfied that I did, that I had enough success to justify, you know, the talent or the ability that I had. But I was also quite passionate, quite interested in other projects, so I was quite excited about getting into those. And this, it felt like no one else at the age of 33 gets the opportunity. Not no one else. Very few other people get the opportunity at 33 to change tack, to get into something different, and just drive a completely different environment and learn a different skill set, and and, you know, be as committed to something as they were then. And that opportunity was quite exciting to me.
So we talked about retirement. You went into retirement and you became an entrepreneur. You co-started Kairos. But before we go into Kairos, when you can tell the people what Kairos is all about, I was wondering what problems did you encounter during your playing times that made you think of, okay, this is something that the market needs. What was the problem solving idea behind it?
My big thing was that I learned quite a lot about myself. I learned about whenever I was in that purple patch, you know, that kind of really good period of my career, whenever I was performing really well, I became a creature of habit, and I started learning what made me tick. What made me tick from a gym perspective, what made me tick from a strategic perspective, you know, preparation, understanding the opposition. And I kind of simplified my approach. And instead of trying to do everything, watching highlights of amazing players, that's what I used to do. It was too loose, didn't relate it to me. So I thought, right, let's find out what makes me tick. And if I had a certain gym score that makes me, you know, feel athletic, feel springy, feel like I'm ready to accelerate hard or be powerful, have a, you know, a strong kind of power output. If something trivial, like I used to get cramp in my calves, so I used to have to get, you know, soft tissue on my calves 2 times a week. My other thing was high ball reception. I made this realization, high ball. So as a winger, quite often there'd be contestable, you know, high balls put on you. You have to climb into the air and just kind of make that successful take. My big thing, what I realized was if my first touch as a winger, quite often that is your first touch. The first touch in the game is a positive one, then usually I play well. My first touch is not so positive, then I try and chase that, and I start to worry about compounding errors. So I used to spend, you know, two blocks of 15 minutes just rehearsing specifically that play, you know, for the first play of the game, making an impact in the game. So I end up having like 5 or 6 different things, like boxes that I had to tick and prepare myself. And then it got to the point where I used to always get very nervous on game day. And in the change room before I went out, I used to kind of worry, what if this goes wrong? What if that goes wrong? And then I realized I started treating my body like a piece of software. And I used to identify the problems and then solve those problems in the preparation. So I used to say, right, I'm going to tick that box, do that preparation, get that massage, do that extra training. So then whenever I got to game day, instead of being nervous, it was like a tool for rational thinking. I used to think, right, now I can... No, there's no reason why I won't perform well, because any potential problems, I've identified them and then created solutions to deal with those problems. So I used to walk out smiling onto the pitch, just thinking I'm very excited about performing. I'm not nervous because there's no reason to be nervous. I might not play well and there'll be something outside of those things, but I'll always, you know, try and keep improving my process, but I'm excited about what I'm going to do. It's very likely I'm going to perform well today, and that's a very powerful tool. So what I realized was I wanted to tap into that for other players and allow, potentially average performers to become good performers. Like that's probably the way I've described myself, reasonably talented, but I had to think through and engineer my performance. So a big part of that is, you know, getting the team to buy into that and having the ability to manage my own performance and put things in place. And a big part of that is scheduling and communicating and managing and organizing, It didn't have to be, you know, 20 different phone calls, loads of text messages, and because that kind of defeats the purpose, that clutters the mind. So I just wanted a piece of software that allowed me to have all the information I need and then to plan my week accordingly, and then just own that week and just completely design and own and engineer my ability to perform at the weekend. So we thought, right, what is the biggest problem for athletes out there? It's confusion, it's communication, it's lackluster communication, it's different departments fighting for space, it's athletes not knowing, you know, what time the bus goes or what color jerseys they are in for training today, you know, or what the additional sessions are, or what the recovery protocols are, or what the, you know, all of this stuff sits in emails and PDFs and everything all over the place. First of all, let's solve that problem, then allow athletes to be a lot more single-minded about managing their own performance and owning that themselves. So that's why we came up with Keros. And Keros is the single digital interface between club and player. All of the athletes have all the information they require. It's one click away. It's not 10 clicks away or 20 clicks away, because if it's 20 clicks away, then they don't have the accountability, because it's effectively lost. It's gone. It's not relevant, and it's not front and center of their minds. So we came up with Keros, and Keros allows athletes just to have all the information, know exactly where they need to be, remove all of the stuff that, you know, takes up cognitive load. You know, the people talk about Barack Obama, you know, wore the same colored suit every day, because there's no point in wasting decision-making time on something trivial. It's like, just give me all the information I have and it's all here. I don't need to think about it or look for it, or I don't need to just waste energy on something that's not important. Just have it all here. Have all the accountability for all that information in one place, and then just get back, you know, shift the focus onto performance. Just get out there and perform, have all the information, and then react to it and absorb that and use that to create a good performance the weekend. So that was the tool we set about designing and engineering and building. And then along the way, it's really important to listen to your customers in different markets. Football is slightly different than rugby, and rugby is slightly different to basketball. And they all have a lot in common, but there's slightly different nuances in terms of how teams communicate with each other. So we were trying to react to that as well. And then gradually the solution became less and less about my story and more about the people that we're working with and the teams that we're working with. So now at this stage, we've got half the Premier League, English Premier League, the football teams. Now we've got, you know, our first NBA team, our first NHL team, our first MLS team, our first MLB team. So we've got a foothold in the States and the big markets over there. And we're looking to build on those and add high profile teams to our customer base.
That's really cool. Yeah, you said several things there. Make one decision to eliminate 50 other ones, right? You watch Lex Friedman.
He
always wears the same suit. It's just simple every day. He wears it just makes him feel like he's a professional and makes him feel comfortable. But it's also, there's no need to make other decisions. You know what you're going to wear, and you just go on about your day. The other thing you said is early on, when you, the perfectionist mind, right? Like it felt like you needed to check all the boxes, and if you didn't check all the boxes, it made you feel a little bit weary about the game day. But if you did check it, then you could comfortably go on with your game and not worry about, of you know, not going the way you wanted to. Did you experience any kind of negative talk or anxiety during those times, that when you didn't do it, that it was really, really affected your game in a negative way when you didn't check one box out of five?
Potentially that's the downfall. If you feel like I'm only fully prepared if I do these five things, if I only do four of them, then am I only 80% prepared, when in reality you're probably just as ready. It highlights that sometimes your thoughts about what your magic formula is, what your preparation needs to be, sometimes it's rational and sometimes it's irrational. So I know a guy I worked, you know, I played with my whole career, he always had to get a massage after a captain's practice, which is the session the day before the game. He always has to get a massage after that practice. And it was just unthinkable that he wouldn't get that massage. But it's probably pretty irrational. If he didn't get that massage, practically, like physically, he probably wouldn't be any different, really. Yeah. But in his head, he thinks he's going to perform better if he gets it. Then if he doesn't get it, then there's a vulnerability there. So it, some of it's rational, some of it's irrational, some of it's sports psychology, and sometimes it's tricking yourself into thinking you're more prepared than you actually are. But it doesn't matter if it makes you prepare better, or if you've got a reason to perform better, then I think sometimes it's rational, sometimes it's irrational, but buy into whatever makes you tick.
Yeah, it's a borderline superstition, and that's I think sports majority of athletes are that way. So they find one thing that really that they need to do. And I've seen players that are really particular with their process, and I think that makes them feel calm. And if it makes them feel good about it, that they have to do it, you know.
But I used to have I realized this. I noticed this behavior in myself one day. We got a new facility, training facility, a new changing room. And the first day I walked into that changing room, I put my bag down in a particular corner. And what happened the second day? I put it in the exact same spot. And then after two or three times, then it was unthinkable that I would put it anywhere else in the changing room. Totally irrational, but that was my new behavior. That was my new routine. And it just sometimes these fall into place, and then sometimes you actually, you know, put them in place. And on that occasion, that's just how I performed or how I prepared.
So, but Kairos is not only for athletes to solve their problems or to optimize their day, let's say. It's also for the club as well to communicate with internally as well as academies, right? So I'm wondering what problem solving is also there for the clubs internally as well as the academies.
Yeah, so from a coaching perspective, they know that when they send information into the group or into an event or into the file sharing section in Kairos, then they know with certainty that that's going to be engaged with. So I suppose the big value to coaches is assurance that they know that the information is going to be received and engaged with. Whereas previously, you know, it would have been a WhatsApp group and you'd be looking for blue ticks, you know, swiping through, and guys have got their blue ticks turned off, and they maybe have to call them and say, oh, the session time has changed. Or, you know, there's all sorts of ways that we can give the coach or the operations staff, you know, the assurance this information has been received and has been engaged with. So that's really important, because then they're shifting accountability. They're saying, I know this stuff as a coach, and I want to communicate this to you. Now I want the assurance. Have you received this? And is this going to improve your performance? And then it's almost like it's just a bit of a disclaimer, I think, from a coach's perspective, that has been delivered and it should have the desired impact. From an academy perspective, and that's the same for everybody. So whether it's medical staff, you know, meeting players on a one-on-one, or sending through rehab programs, or whether it's operations staff, you know, sending through information about travel itineraries or anything like that. Everybody has, you know, something important that they need to, could be performance or non-performance related. So, and then from an academy perspective, there's a whole different set of problems. So one of the things there is child safeguarding is really important to soccer academies in England or anywhere, really. And there's been a few horror stories in the past about information, you know, falling into the wrong hands, or, you know, people engaging with young footballers in an inappropriate way. And you know, we've solved all those problems. You know, we've got a complete audit trail of anything that's said through the Kairos Messenger that can be pulled up, and then you end up with this nice situation where you've got a formal professional way to communicate from parents and kids to academy directors and coaches. And then you've got an informal way to communicate, and from the player or from the parent, you know, they use their WhatsApp just like everybody else, but they, in their head, they've got, when I communicate through this platform, it's a social engagement. When I communicate through this platform, it's serious. It's not professional, but it's serious. And this is how we engage, and it's a different tone. It's a different app. It's suitable that it's a different app or a different platform. And we've also got the ability for kids to highlight anything they're uncomfortable with from a safeguarding perspective. They can anonymously let, you know, an admin or someone involved in the club know, you know, anything that's going on. Other thing is, from a medical intervention perspective, there could be some communication that goes on WhatsApp, or there could be some diagnosis or misdiagnosis. Again, we have a complete audit trail of anything that's said in the messenger. So it's a nice way of kind of just removing one risk factor and then allowing guys just to communicate in the best way they want to.
Interesting. I that's really down my alley. All this communication, putting everybody on the same page, so there's nothing lost in translation. Because, like you said, in WhatsApp groups, there's a lot of things that get lost along the way if people are not online at the same time and nobody's able to scroll back because there's millions of messages. But I think that there's a lot of there could be a lot of interest also in the basketball community, just in terms of managing club internally and communicating with the players and having everybody's schedule aligned with the staff and bringing everybody on the same page. I think that's key these days, especially with a dynamic schedule like basketball, because things are happening all the time with travels, two games a week, you know, and there needs to be quick and efficient communication, I think, these days.
Yeah, absolutely. If they have to get a travel itinerary, a PDF, and then if anything changes there, then it's redrafted, it'll be published, and they're not sure which one the most up-to-date one is, and then it might relate to a dress code or a code of conduct that sits in a file somewhere else. So it's just nice having that all in one place, and then the player just has to think less and they can be more focused on the important bits. But yeah, any kind of change of plans or itineraries have to be flexible. Because that's just the nature. You might have to train in a different venue because of weather. You might have to travel a different way because of weather as well, or difficulties around fixtures or any kind of flexibility. We've all seen plenty of flexibility with COVID over the last few years, and hopefully that's not something that we have to worry about too much. But yeah, it's important to be flexible and then just to make sure that whenever there is a change, that everybody's up to speed and everybody knows where they need to be really, really quickly.
For sure. Yeah. I will link to the information in the show notes for everybody who's interested to find out more and the link to the website. I wanted to touch on also about Potholes and Penguins. Tell me a little bit about that podcast. you're a busy man as well.
Yeah, Potholes and Penguins. So I'll try and be as succinct as possible. But whenever we're playing rugby, there's people called potholes, and potholes are people who take you aside and say, they want to talk to you about rugby and they want to talk to you about what they think you should be doing, and they've just got too much to say for themselves. And a pothole when you come across one. I still see potholes every night. As soon as they start talking to me, I know this guy's a pothole. Okay? So a pothole basically is just someone you want to avoid, like you'd avoid a pothole. But the thing is, I'm a bit of a pothole at times as well, because I'm quite nerdy about rugby and I love talking about rugby, and like players typically want to get away from people who are, I'm only an element of that, but there's people who are like fully pothole. So then we used to do our podcast. We used to do a Game of Thrones segment, and the Game of Thrones segment, we used to get a player, someone who's following Game of Thrones closely to discuss the most recent episode. And then because we were Game of Thrones fans, we used to love the idea about Varys is the eunuch from Game of Thrones, and he used to say how he had all of his little birds in all corners of the kingdom, and he was finding out gossip about the kingdom. We thought, wouldn't it be nice if we had penguins? Like, we thought it was kind of slightly derogatory. We thought it was like the nice kind of tone, penguins, to feedback information, rugby gossip, who's injured, who's available, who's getting selected this weekend. So we thought there's a nice kind of balance where we want penguins and we want potholes. And ultimately it's like the yin and yang of life, where everybody's not completely pothole, not completely penguin. Everybody's got an element of both. So we kind of ran with this this explanation and this name for our podcast. So we try, and the principle we work from is it's myself and two other ex-rugby players. If we got together and went for a drink, we would probably talk a little bit about rugby, but we would talk about life, family, movies, music, everything else in between. Yeah. And I think that's a nice kind of tone for a podcast, where you don't just talk about the title. So we would spend probably 20-30% of the time talking about rugby, and the rest we go wherever direction the podcast takes us. So
that's cool. Yeah, I enjoy those conversations a lot, just because there's so much that gets lost in the pro world, because everybody thinks that those athletes don't have a life, but there's actually a lot of things happening behind the scenes that nobody sees, family, the balance between life and work and travel and managing all the time with the family and personal time, hobbies, anything, you know. So there's a lot of things that are happening. There's athletes are people too, coaches are people too, and they have lives as well, just as anybody else. And even though
my co-host is a guy called Barry Murphy, who used to play for Munster, a rival team for us whenever we played. So we played against each other, and we were kind of pretty staunch rivals. And since he finished, he retired early. He retired at the age of 28 with a career-ending injury. And since then, he started a band. They play in Limerick. They play in like traditional Irish music, and slightly more contemporary. So he's very unlike someone to move out of a professional rugby career and then move in to be a very successful singer in a band. So he's slightly more arty. Farty, more creative. You know, he's not just a dumb rugby player. You know, he's got something else to him. So it's kind of conducive to an interesting chat.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. There was this American soccer player in the 90s, Lala, this redhead player that was really, really, it was a national team soccer player, but he was also a guitarist afterwards. Like, he was really good with the guitar. I forgot his name, but he was another example that went into music afterwards. Yeah. I finish off the podcast always with quick hitters. We call them ATO sometimes, or quick hitters that are just a drop, quick plays, and the guest answers them. So it's a quick question with a quick answer, whatever pops into your head. It's sometimes a little bit deeper below the surface, so just be ready, maybe you can take your time and put some thought into it.
Okay. Great.
One habit that impacts your daily life.
I have to train. I have to train every day.
It's just in your blood.
Yeah, I have to. I'll get grumpy with my kids if I don't do something actively.
Something, whether it's a lesson or an attitude you took from your pro days into personal life and your new career.
Come with something to say. So yeah, that was my big thing. I felt like in a meeting in a rugby context, I always had to have something. If I was put on the spot, you have to have something to say. So I try and do the same thing in business now, I suppose.
Something you believe in that other things is crazy.
That's a good one. I'm tempted to believe in aliens.
me too. It goes to tinfoil head.
Yeah, I'm not quite there yet. The podcast host Barry is a big fan of aliens, listens to every Joe Rogan podcast.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm close. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm close.
Hey, I'm in the same as that little triangle there with your friend and Joe Rogan. I've listened to that, and there's a lot of believable stuff out there. That's just, I mean, you're I'm really close to that. I'm really, really close to that. I'm not saying I'm 100% there, but there's got to be something out there, just by judging by the endlessness of our universe.
The size. Yeah. Like, rationally, it's so vast.
Yeah, percentage wise, it's hard to think otherwise. You know, that there has to be some sort of way of tracking back of where we came from, and then what was there before, and if there was somebody before us that's already light years ahead of us, and they're just watching us of where we're gonna go. You know, there's another version of us out there. I'm not gonna go into that.
There's another Benas, and there's another Andrew, and they're doing a podcast right now, and they're talking about it. And they are aliens, and they know. So they're talking about basketball and rugby.
They already know where we're going with this.
Exactly. Yeah.
One skill you wish you had.
I'd love to be able to sing. I can't sing.
Best personal investment.
Financial investment here, are we talking?
Personal. It could be anything. It could be something that you use on a daily basis, or something lessons you took that help you be a better speaker, for example.
No, nothing that highbrow. It's a coffee machine. We bought a new coffee machine at the start of COVID, and we've never looked back. And now we're coffee connoisseurs. We're coffee snobs now.
So I do have a like you have a different segment on your podcast. I have a segment of coffee. I did one episode so far with the Europe from with the owner or the guy who started European Coffee Trip, and he came on my podcast. We talked a little bit about coffee. That was summer and a half ago. And I had one recording, another recording in Hawaii that I didn't publish because the audio was just too bad, and it was unfortunate. But I'm trying to record coffee episodes on different parts of the world when I'm on the road sometimes, but it doesn't work out that way all the time. But yeah, I love coffee. Did you buy a machine with caps, or did you buy a machine where you can do it yourself?
No beans, do it yourself.
Oh, you're the man. You're accepted in the circle of coffee trust.
Yeah, we got the filter size, all of the numbers, basically all of the things that you can change. We got one that works, and then we just stuck with it. So like I would never, if someone changes the numbers, the coffee's gonna taste like shit, and I'm just gonna be like, I don't know what to do. You know, I don't know how to fix it. So we're not like, we've just got something that works for us, but if it ever goes wrong, we're in trouble.
Yeah, it's good. I haven't bought one because I'm on the road so much. It doesn't make sense for me. But I bought an AeroPress that I can take anywhere with me, and I have it at home. Yeah. And it's just small filters, and I push it out, and I got my cup of coffee.
It's a coffee for one, though. I know, like espresso machine is a coffee for one as well, but it's quicker. The AeroPress is more of a, you need to like the process.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's you need. I do like the process, but I far prefer the process of drinking the coffee, and I wanted to get there as quick as possible.
Yeah, let's get on to the good part as quick as possible. I got two more for you. Something that makes rugby union so much different from other sports that other people would not even think of.
I think it's probably the values piece. I think it's the values and the culture and the rugby community. I summarized quite well, I think, in that rugby players don't talk back to referees. I know that's been challenged a few times recently. If you did a bit of research, Bennett, you could challenge me on that big time, because there's been a few examples recently. But generally, I think that's probably what's a little bit unique about rugby.
Okay. Advice from your current self to your younger self.
To my old self. My big thing, this is a little bit long-winded, if you're happy. My big thing was I always doubted myself. I think I mentioned it earlier on. I always used to get nervous on game day. I used to always kind of just check myself and doubt myself, and I wish I had got over that earlier, because what I realized was I went back to study when I was in my late 20s or early 30s actually, with two kids, night classes, studying finance, which I'd never studied before. And what I realized was, if I commit to something, if I really really immerse myself in it, I can do really well. And I wish I had told myself, my like early 20s, late teens self, that don't doubt yourself at anything, because if you work hard at something, you can get really good at it. And my big thing was I really doubled down on understanding my routine, and I started playing really good rugby. I got immersed myself in my studies, and I got really good at that. And then, you know, since playing rugby, I immersed myself in the business and making this solution better, making this business bigger, better, and building this business and scaling this business. Every step along the way, I've had to learn a whole new skill set. But I know now that even though I don't know anything about that, if I immerse myself in it and I work really hard at it, I can be really good at it in, you know, 6 months, 12 months, whatever it takes. So it's not having confidence that you're good at everything, but having confidence that if you work hard at it, you could be good at it. And I wish I'd told myself my early or my late teens that lesson.
Confidence into the process. Confidence in the process.
Yeah, back myself. Just back yourself for something. You can learn it and you can get good at it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good one. I just thought of last one, and that's a Tim Ferriss special, and I asked that a lot of times, athletes as well as coaches. What's your favorite failure when you look back? Something that you look back on, it was a failure, but you grew from that tremendously, and that you cherish until this day.
Favorite failure. Not sure if it's a brilliant example. I changed position, like position in rugby, a year into playing professional rugby. I broke through in one position, and then I effectively got dropped, and then I changed position. So you could argue a field at playing that position, and I had to find another position. So that's my favorite failure, because then I played the rest of my career in that position, and that position was probably a better fit for me anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. That's a good one. So that's it. We made it. Yeah, you went through the gauntlet of my podcast. Andrew, I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for coming on, and please tell everyone how they can find you if they want to reach out one way or another.
Nice one, Ben. It's really good to spend a bit of time with you. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed that.
Thank you. And everybody, tune in and find Andrew on social media if you want to follow him. And see you next time, everyone. Peace.
Cheers, guys.